First up in the second hour of the program, though, we welcome back to the show an acclaimed documentary filmmaker. His movies have won Emmy Awards, Grammys, Peabody Awards. He is an Oscar nominee. Films that have told the story of America, like the Civil War, baseball, jazz, Ali, country music, the Vietnam War, and his newest, Benjamin Franklin, which premieres Monday night on PBS. We're happy to welcome Ken Burns back to downtown. Well, hello there, Ken. Thanks for coming back with us for, the third time in a year. You're on the show almost as much as I am, and frankly, you're shaming us with your productivity lately.
Well, we've got another one coming out in September, too, on the U.S. and the Holocaust, so hang on. I don't think I'll work on a more important film than that one, but anyway.
Well, this
I'm happy to be with you.
This new film is so good and very interesting, as always, for a man who was arguably the most famous American in his own time. There was still a lot that I didn't know about Benjamin Franklin. Is that what drives you as a filmmaker, to find those untold stories?
Yeah, I mean, I have to freely admit I was among the ignorant. I don't make films about things I know and think you should know about. The last time I checked, that's called homework. what I'd rather do with you is share our process of discovery. Our writer, Dayton Duncan, and my co-producer, David Schmidt, the editor, Craig Mellish, and the whole team. And to say, you know, I probably went in, I can't really remember, thinking that lightning had to strike the kite, the child, conventional wisdom. And then all of this, most of it was a mystery. You know, he's held up because he's on the $100 bill and not for any accident. He's held up as this sort of symbol, generation after generation of American striving, of pulling yourself up by your bootstraps, a kind of libertarian hero. But he'd be, you know, pretty shocked by that, because he always felt that personal success had to be tethered to civic responsibility and to generosity. And so, you know, he held all of his famous inventions, including the lightning rod, without patent, made no money on them whatsoever. The bifocals, the catheter, the improvements on the wood stove, all of the things that he did and much more, all was a way of being the unum part of E Pluribus Unum, our model. But he is without a doubt the most known American of the 18th century in the world for his scientific discoveries. He's our best writer. He's our best humorist. He's a successful businessman, a printer, a publisher, a publisher of almanacs, a newspaper man, a postmaster. He doesn't get into politics until late middle age. And he's the oldest of the founding fathers and the greatest diplomat in American history. Without his working his magic with the French, we would have not won the Revolution. And he's the one who had the great honor of proposing the adoption of the Constitution at the Constitutional Convention, which passed. Many of them compromises that he designed. Some of them, we look back now and understand how tragic those consequences were for other people, particularly the enslaved people of the South. But he nevertheless helped create the country. And he, at that time, is as famous, if not more famous, than George Washington. But he understood how things went. He was a very wise man and sort of allowed Washington to sort of take the lead, as he said.
He's a man of many contradictions, none more so than the evolution of his view on slavery. Early on in the film, we learn that he was worried about the influx of what he called swarthy immigrants, and yet one of his last public acts was to advocate for abolition. He called it that last errata to be corrected.
Yes, exactly. And those swarthy immigrants were Germans. And I think, you know, having just finished the film on the Holocaust, the Nazis would be pretty upset to hear that Benjamin Franklin thought that they were swarthy, because, of course, they thought themselves the ideal of whiteness, and a lot of bad stuff came out of that. Yes, he had very bizarre views in many cases, pretty much of the time, and in some instances, you know, he laments those swarthy German immigrants coming in, but he loves the lovely white and red, meaning he's got already a kind of romanticizing of the native population, which he's both very sympathetic to and tolerant of and critical of those people who abuse them, but also very happy to dispossess them of their lands and print the treaties that are doing just that and speculating in land in the Ohio Valley that would, of course, displace even more native peoples. But, you know, the biggest thing is once he'd made a success, he enslaved several people in his household. And the number's not exactly precise. We don't know what happened to all of them. We know at least one ran away. And while his son, William, put out an ad when they were in London seeking that person, King was his name's return, they did kind of very little. But he started a school for black children in Philadelphia and was surprised, to see that they had equal aptitude with whites in all things. And I think that's the beginning. He's beginning to understand, you know, the question of slavery is an issue in Pennsylvania and had been from before he was born. Just people debating the morality of it, particularly the Quakers who founded the state. And so, you know, he evolves. And so by the time that he has helped work out the Three-Fifths Compromise, he's also becoming the head of a Pennsylvania Society for Promoting the Abolition of Slavery, and he's given the task of introducing into Congress the this resolution abolishing slavery. You know, it's a pretty amazing journey for one man to make, and we're happy he made it. I think he offers us a portal into our founding that's warts and all, but has a sense of humor, which he did, but also has a sense of progress. The other founding fathers, Washington, Jefferson, they're all static, you know? They don't change. You know, they can write all men are created equal, Thomas Jefferson, but he's not going to free his slaves. And that, I think, is the interesting part about Benjamin Franklin is that he's corrigible. You know, he's looking, he's learning, he wants to improve himself his whole life, and does, and gets on, as the scholar Erica Dunbar says in our film, gets on the right side of history.
You told us many years ago that race may well be the single most important issue in American history, but I remember you also said you don't go looking for it, but it's always there.
It's always there, and you can't help it. How could it be when we're founded on the idea that all men are created equal? And yet the guy who wrote that, Thomas Jefferson, owned hundreds of other human beings in his lifetime. That's a hypocrisy and a contradiction that he couldn't really handle or deal with in his lifetime, and he didn't free his slaves in his lifetime. So what we have is this American conundrum. You know, Condoleezza Rice, in a conversation about Benjamin Franklin the other day, called it our birth defect. Historians are often quoted as calling it our original sin. I think it's better to take it out of the religious dimension and just say, you know, we started off on the wrong foot in many ways, despite the greatness of our country. And we've spent an awful lot of time and energy and many steps backwards trying to address the consequences of having not addressed it at the beginning. And that's, you know, part of who we are. I would say the most important theme is freedom. And there again, Franklin is very much involved in this, because that argument about paying back is part of this whole question about freedom. For a lot of people, freedom is what I want. Just that. And we also know that in order to be a working country, it also has to respect what we need. And sometimes that's at odds. You know, what I want and what we need are not always the same thing. They were having a discussion about inoculation at the time. I mean, Washington ordered that the entire Continental Army be inoculated against smallpox. You know, that was the thing. And there were some people who didn't think that that made sense, because wasn't it giving you a little bit of a disease? So that tension, it runs throughout American history. And Franklin understands it. He's all about compromise. He's all about civil discourse and finding a way. He's also a kid whose parents want him to, they're lower middle class candle makers, but they want him to go to Harvard. So they put him in a school, and they can only afford 2 years, and they pull him out, and he becomes an indentured servant to his brother, indentured servant, one step away from actual slavery, to his brother, James, who runs a printing press. Thank God for the rest of the world, because he learns this hyper-literacy, as the writer Joyce Chaplin says in our film, you know, setting type upside down and backwards, carrying the heavy things made his body strong. But he was a voracious reader, and because he only had two years of schooling, the scholar H.W. Brands in our film says, you know, he didn't know what he didn't have to know. School teaches you what you should know, but it also teaches you what you don't have to know. So Benjamin Franklin didn't know what he didn't have to know, and so he decided he'd have to know everything. And so what you have is this genius, born genius, but this voracious curiosity, this unbelievable reader, this guy with a wonderful sense of humor, and then feeling that he has to know everything in order to get ahead, and does in one of the greatest success stories you could ever imagine. I mean, after his electricity experiments, and let's remember, you know, we get distracted by the kite story because it's cute, but this is a revolutionary thing. This is on the caliber of an Isaac Newton kind of gravity discovery. And the things that he does in kind of layman's terms that he applies to what he observes are all things we use today. Now, I don't know anything about electricity. I'm guessing you don't either. But you've heard of negative and positive. You've heard of charge. You've heard of battery. You've heard of conductor. These are all Franklin's terms to help understand and communicate the discoveries of the properties of this heretofore unknown or sort of parlor game trick, you know, creating static electricity so you a spark happens when you kiss somebody.
We're talking with Ken Burns here on Downtown. You mentioned inoculation, and that's one of the most powerful stories in the film, the story of his own son, Francis.
Yes, this is a powerfully sad story. I pause because it makes me, it makes me so sad. I mean, it just moves me to tears. His son Frankie had a cold, and in those days, the inoculation for the smallpox, the inoculation really wiped you out. So the thought was, he was a great proponent, and he wrote about it in his newspapers. He argued in favor of it. There wasn't the kind of ridiculous arguments we have today. It was just good science, and men of religion were behind it too. Cotton Mather, the Puritan leader in Massachusetts, was promoting inoculation. It wasn't, you know, and everybody could sort of get the gist of it. But they knew how tough it would be on his system. They wait. And poor Frankie, I'm going to tear up. You know, poor Frankie gets smallpox and dies. And it's the tragedy of his and Deborah, his common-law wife's thing. It's very, very sad.
His family life was complicated, from his relationship with Deborah to the relationship with his son William. And I wonder too if, in the research, you found that humor that we know Franklin for came from that sadness that's the basis of so much humor.
Yes, I think that's right. It's Mark Twain who said, the source of laughter is not joy, but sorrow. There is no laughter in heaven. And so when you see this life that is tongue-in-cheek in many ways, one of the commentators in the film says he's the only founding father that winks at you and evidently had a sense of humor. That's sort of the first entree into Benjamin Franklin, and yet so much of it is parts of struggles. And I would think that everybody understands that. As much as we want happiness and calm seas, the things that define us are more often the tragedies or the difficulties or the obstacles, the mountains we have to climb, the rough seas that we have to weather. My mother died when I was 11, and look what I do for a living. You know, I wake the dead. My late father-in-law, a eminent psychologist, told me, you know, that's what I do for a living. He said, who do you think you're really trying to wake up? So I think that many of the things that have helped us along, given definition to our lives, are often sorrowful. And I think Franklin understood that. Twain would most definitely understand that and articulate it. And I think that's part of telling a complicated story. I mean, too often we either have a kind of, you know, revisionist history in which we discover that somebody in the past has done something that we don't approve of now, so they're gone. Then we have the other kind in which it's so sanitized in Madison Avenue kind that you can't really learn anything. And I guess we've introduced a new one, which is we can't even talk about certain things. We can't mention certain things that are facts of life and history and human endeavor. And we'd prefer none of those. We'd prefer a deep dive that understands the story of us, the U.S., but also us, the intimacy of us, in all its warts and complications. You know, the journalist I.F. Stone once said, when one of his acolytes said, "How can you admire Jefferson who owned other human beings?" He said, "Young man, because history is not melodrama, it's tragedy." That is to say, in melodrama, all heroes are perfectly virtuous and all villains are perfectly villainous. But life isn't like that. Everybody's complicated. The Greek mythologies have told us that. Achilles had his heel and his hubris to go along with his great strength. And so we have to tell stories that understand the tragedy of human existence, the fact that people can be one thing and also another, can be greedy on one hand and generous on another hand, that some of these divisions that we can obviously identify between people are often divisions that are within us and the people we love the most, who are not going to be dismissed. We're not going to kick them out of our lives. We're going to figure out how to tolerate, correct, amend, love, reconcile, whatever it might be, those things. And that's the great gift of telling a complicated history. Franklin reminds us to kind of not take ourselves so pompously and so sanctimoniously, that we can look back and kind of arrogantly dismiss those who have gone before us as lesser people.
Benjamin Franklin premieres Monday, April 4th on PBS, and there's a real turning point in Franklin's life at the end of episode one, when he's essentially called on the carpet in England and, entered the cockpit of Brit and came out an American.
Yeah, it's an amazing story. And his sympathies are beginning to go that way anyway. He's been trying to settle the disputes between the colonies. He's representing several colonies in addition to Pennsylvania in England. He spent years there, 15 of the last 17 years of his wife Deborah's life. Doesn't return to her when she's sick. He's trying to work out deals, trying to get his son William ahead, who ends up the royal governor of New Jersey, and that's a whole other split. But yes, he thinks he makes a huge political mistake. He thinks that by leaking some letters of a political friend of his back in Massachusetts, he can help calm tensions on both sides. Instead, he exacerbates them. And when he has to admit that he was the one who leaked the letters, here's a postmaster leaking letters. This is a friend leaking letters. This is, you know, this is a dastardly, underhanded thing. And so he's goes into a place called the Cockpit, which is a place where Henry VIII held cockfights in Whitehall, this sort of Westminster, place of government. And he is berated for an hour. He takes it silently by this ambitious prosecutor named Wedderburn. And as one of our commentators says, you know, he walked in a Briton and came out an American. And that's really a good way to summarize his beginning to see, by living in England, the kind of corruption all around him, just as his son William in the United States now as a royal governor is beginning to sort of feel that all of this protest is in some ways, you know, self-indulgent and corrupt itself. And so the son's moving in one direction, the father in another, and they had once been the closest of friends, just almost like best friends together, inseparable. And it's one of the great tragedies of the story of Franklin's life that his son, the last royal governor to be deposed, is in prison for a while, exchanged with prisoners, and presumed that he'd go back to England. Instead, he starts a terrorist organization killing patriots. Mm. And look, there are lots of patriot organizations killing loyalists. But, Franklin never reconciled with his son again.
Jefferson sent Benjamin Franklin a draft, the first draft of the Declaration of Independence, and Franklin made what proved to be a pretty key edit.
Yeah, it's one of the great things in the history, the inner kind of history of our country, that you just have to do it by, you know, go to the American Philosophical Society, where they've got a copy of the Declaration of Independence in Jefferson's hand, very available, not like the formal script that you see. And Jefferson has said, we hold these truths to be sacred and undeniable. And then goes on with all of the wonderful stuff of that great second sentence of the Declaration, distilling a century of Enlightenment thinking into one sentence. It's just remarkable, and it's our catechism. It's why we're American, you know? But Jefferson said, but Franklin looks at it and says, this is beautiful, but not sacred and undeniable. This is self-evident. We're in the age of Enlightenment. We are holding things to be true. The sun rises in the east and sets in the west. And so Jefferson yields immediately, and you can see the emendations. You can see the correction on the copy. It's so beautiful, and it's so exciting to feel like you're at that moment where, you know, Jefferson moves to Philadelphia. He writes alone a draft attended by a slave, Robert Hemings, and he feels honor-bound to send it to the wisest man in the colonies, Benjamin Franklin. And Benjamin Franklin recognizes the beautiful prose, but makes this correction. And it's, as Clay Jenkinson, a writer in our film, a scholar in our film, says, you know, world class. And boy, is it. You know, and it's a pretty gutsy call, too, to say self-evident, you know, to say that these rights, you know, for all of mankind, people have been ruled by rulers, by tyrants, not by the consent of the governed. And they're suggesting the most radical thing in human governmental organization, and they're saying, yep, this is the way it is, and always has been. It's self-evident that this is this way, and it's beautiful. And yet, when he comes out of the Constitutional Convention and is asked what they've actually created, a monarchy or a republic, he says to Elizabeth Willing Powell, a leading lady of Philadelphia, whose own rights were not addressed at all in the Constitution, as so many others were not, he says, a republic if you can keep it. So he understood that though these things may be self-evident, they're still very fragile and require a kind of cooperation, a willingness to compromise. And I think he'd be extremely disappointed by the bitter partisanship today, where everybody's their own independent free agent. You go to Congress not to get things done, but to make a lot of noise, usually against something, rarely for something.
You mentioned the Enlightenment. Do you think that his intense interest in the Enlightenment movement is what drove him to be part of so many firsts, the first library, the first volunteer fire department, so many firsts in his life? Was that intimately tied to his study of the Enlightenment?
I think it's a series of things. The Enlightenment is, of course, something born in Scotland and Europe, you know, by many men of religion, David Hume, others who are writing about John Locke, about the essential rights of human beings as you escape the kind of religious tyranny as well as the monarchical tyranny that is governing almost everyone's existence, at least in Europe. And he's reading as a kid, and he's imbibing all of this as a kid and a young man, and he's starting a discussion group with his fellow tradesmen, his fellow workers, you know, the leather apron club called the Junto, which means coming from the Latin to join together. So he's interested in the symbolism of people coming together, and later on, as the Enlightenment you know, permeates down, all of these things, the libraries are reflections of that. It's really it's pretty fantastic.
You talked a little bit about his efforts to recruit France to the colonist side, but how important was his work in negotiating the Treaty of Paris?
Well, you know, first of all, the French thing is amazing because, you know, we sort of forget this. We think of, you know, Washington at Valley Forge and Bunker Hill and Lexington and Concord and all of these great things. But if you look at Yorktown, Washington's there with 9,000 federal, 9,000 Continental soldiers, most of them clothed and armed by France. Thank you, Dr. Franklin. With him are an almost equal number of French soldiers led by the Marquis de Lafayette. Thank you, Dr. Franklin. Or at least Marquis de Lafayette is part of that crowd. And blocking Cornwallis's escape by sea is a French fleet. Thank you very much, Dr. Franklin. So this is, you know, the key. No Franklin, no us, no United States. But then, and he's done it with this kind of suavity, as Clay Jenkinson says, and this wonderful sort of foot off the gas. Yes, yes, not getting anything done to the outside observers, but getting everything done because they love the development of the relationships with this most famous of Americans, this most famous of men on earth, you know, and they give him what he wants. Then he goes into the negotiation with the Brits, and he is hard-nosed. He is pedal to the metal. He is, you know, you want reparations? What about us reparations? You burn this city, you burn that city. No way. And even Adams and the other negotiators there are kind of stunned at his vehemence and his anger. And maybe some of it has to do in large part because of his frustrations with William's obstinacy about staying loyal. It's a complicated story, but you know, that Treaty of Paris is so one-sided. First of all, the other Americans wanted to exclude the French, which Franklin initially didn't, but let them have their way. And then he had the task of explaining to the French why it didn't why they weren't involved and they didn't get anything out of it. And, you know, he does it so diplomatically that he says, and oh, by the way, we need some more money, and they gave it to him. And Britain, you know, is kind of locked out. And so what you have created is an American empire. It's really a spectacular thing. The United States that the Treaty of Paris creates is not the 13 colonies clinging tenuously to the East Coast. It now extends to the Mississippi River and from Canada to the northern border of Florida. And it's bigger than England and France and Spain combined. So it's like, watch out, right? Just Franklin's negotiation with the French causes Cornwallis to surrender to Washington at Yorktown. And now you've got a new world power with unbelievable natural resources.
I was delighted to hear friend of our show, Mandy Patinkin. He was perfect as the voice of Benjamin Franklin. What inspired that choice?
Well, thank you for recognizing that. I think, you know, most of the success of this film has a lot to do with the beautiful script by Dayton Duncan and the beautiful editing by Craig Mellish and the producing by David Schmidt and the folks who've been collecting the collecting the paintings and the drawings. There are no photographs. And making it come alive. But Mandy makes Benjamin Franklin come alive. And I was watching Homeland and had just an epiphany. And he said, yes, all in COVID. I have yet to meet him physically. We've been on many Zooms together. He was blown away by the film a year plus later we gave him the finished copy after he had spent an arduous day reading it with just an incredible intention and focus. And understanding and inhabiting of every single word. It really just comes alive, and Franklin doesn't seem in some far-off galaxy, some distant century, but like right with us. So, Mandy is just a wonderful human being, a wonderful actor, and a great contributor to this, and I'm glad I had that epiphany, and he now thinks that it ranks with the three best things he's done. Sunday in the Park with George, the Sondheim musical, The Princess Bride, and this. And I said, but what about Saul Berenson, the role he plays on Homeland? I said, yeah, but, you know, this. And he's a mensch. He's a wonder, as you know, he's a wonderful, wonderful human being.
Ken, as a history teacher, I always try to make things relevant and help students understand how our past impacts us today. How does the story of Benjamin Franklin help us learn about ourselves in 2022?
In every way conceivable. It's so funny that when you tell a good story historically, it lawfully resonates in the present. It is about us. You know, people like to say history repeats itself. It doesn't. But human nature remains the same. And if you can get under the skin of that human nature of another age, it is a huge lesson for us today. So there isn't an area that's civic, political, moral, religious, intimate, that Franklin isn't there speaking exactly to things that are going on in our own lives. And I think it's hugely important, particularly as we find ourselves so divided, to at least go back to people that are beloved on both sides of the aisle or on both sides of this partisan divide and begin to realize how healing these stories can be, how transformative these stories can be. You know, the novelist Richard Powers says, the best arguments in the world won't change a single person's point of view. The only thing that can do that is a good story.
Well, it is that indeed, a wonderful film that premieres Monday night, April 4th on PBS, Benjamin Franklin. Ken, as always, thank you so much for making time for us. We appreciate it. Wish you continued success and hope to talk with you about the U.S. and the Holocaust later in the year.
Look forward to that. Thanks so much.